We're actually coming to the, today's the last Sunday in the series we've been in that is Money Talks. It's the Money Talk series we've been in. Kind of a unique series for us. We don't typically do, well, I have never done a series on money. I'll just say it that way. Not only is it not typical, I have never done this. But our commitment from the very beginning of this series was threefold. That one is that this would be a no shame zone. This was not going to be a heavy-handed series on money. Secondly, that it was going to be helpful. That wherever you are right now, that this would be helpful to your personal finances. And then lastly, that we were going to bring in some specialists, some coaches who this is their vocational life, is helping people, helping Christians specifically, steward their finances and to do better with that and to grow in that. And so today's the final series, and that it's going to be a little bit different. We're going to basically, instead of a theme, it's going to be a Q&A Sunday. So we'll put that up here. We'll put our title slide up here. But it's going to be a Q&A. I'm going to start with a little bit of a message, and then James and Amberlee are going to join us as they've been doing and share with us. Before we do that, I just want to say one last thing. The final part of this, which is probably the part that is going to, I think you're going to experience it as the most helpful part, is that on Saturday, a week from yesterday, we're going to have a workshop in the chapel on Saturday morning from 9 a.m. till 12:30. And James and Amberlee are going to be introducing some tools there for personal finance. So these are things that they do with the clients that they coach. They're going to be giving some of those tools away, specifically to help you as Christians with our finances, right? And so it's not a one-size-fits-all. It is some tools that you can utilize wherever you are right now. And whatever your financial circumstances are right now, these are going to help you to be a better steward as a follower of Jesus. So that's the registration code. If you're online, you can use that as well to register. We'd ask if you register just so we can plan for materials and coffee and snacks and things like that. But I would really encourage you to do that. Part that commitment we made that this is going to be helpful, this is going to be the part that you're going to experience as truly helpful, building on all of the things that we've talked about these last 5 weeks. So with that said, this morning we're going to be in this message and the Q&A time. Where's my, there it is. Each Sunday of the series, we've rooted into one of Jesus' parables to begin with. It's been interesting to see how often Jesus' parables actually dealt with the topic of money. Living in a human environment, and how do we as Christians steward our resources? And the nature of parables, we've talked about this throughout, is that parables are always, they're story formed, so they're memorable. But one of the things about parables is they always have a surprising twist. There's something that happens where you're tracking with the story, and Jesus' listeners would have been tracking with the story. And then there's a plot twist that is kind of shocking. It's surprising. And what it does is it exposes the human heart to something that maybe we weren't aware of. And in that, there's an invitation to then respond to Jesus' way of life. Jesus, his central message as he arrived here on our planet was announcing the arrival of the kingdom of God and the invitation to live in the kingdom of God, not just in the kingdom of man, not just in a fallen world and a human economy. And so these parables are always an invitation. Today we're going to be in, it's not going to be in so much a parable. I would call it an enacted parable, because the story we're going to be in this morning actually happened. It's not a fictional one that Jesus made up. It's one that he actually experienced and witnessed and was so captivated by that he called his disciples' attention to it and said, I want you to see what's happening here. But I would call it an acted parable because it has that same element. It has a plot twist that's unexpected. And there's an invitation to not just notice what happened, but to respond to it. So we're going to be in Mark chapter 12 today. And as we get there, I'll give you a little bit of just kind of a context for what's happening. This is Jesus' Passion Week. It's the final week of his earthly life. As we pick up, it's going to be Tuesday. Here's how the week plays out. On Thursday, Jesus will have the Last Supper with his disciples. Friday, he'll be crucified. Sunday will be the resurrection. We're on Tuesday, and Jesus knows everything that's about to happen, and so that's weighing on him. Additionally, the week has already been filled with conflict. There's been conflict between the religious leaders and Jesus, between the civic leaders and Jesus, and in the midst of that conflict, there's this little kind of like pause. It's like a little intermission in which something really beautiful happens that captivates Jesus' heart and attention. That's what we're gonna be looking at today. Mark 12:41. Jesus sat down opposite the treasury and he watched the people putting money into the offering box. Many rich people put in large sums, okay? Jesus is just, he's sitting back, he's observing this. They had offering poles across the room, right? And he's observing all this, and he noticed that rich people were putting in big offerings. Now, how did he know that? Here's how he knew that. So this is most likely the court of the Gentiles or the court of women, where there was 13 shofar chests is what they were. And so basically these are trumpet-shaped offering boxes that are made out of metal. So when an offering was put into one of the shofar boxes, they were not only visible, they were audible. Because people weren't dropping in checks. They weren't, you know, using Venmo. Right? They were dropping in coins. And so there was a sound. And the larger the coin, the larger the offering, the larger the sound. And so who are these people that are doing this? Well, these are religious pilgrims. Remember, it's Passion Week, which means it's also Passover Week. So Jewish people from around the Roman Empire have all come to Israel, maybe for the only time this year, or maybe this is a once in a lifetime trip. And so with them, they've brought their tithes and offerings and they're bringing this and they're putting it in. Okay, so that's what's happening. Jesus is watching and then something different happens. Verse 42, a poor widow came. She put in two small copper coins, which make a penny. Into the scene of all these wealthy people giving impressive offerings and loud clanging every time an offering was dropped in a box, comes this poor widow and she drops in these two small coins, so insignificant that they can barely be heard. Plink, plink. The coins, they would have been Roman lepta. We have pennies, they had lepta. Lepta were the lightest and the least valuable coin in circulation. They were the equivalent together to lepta, made 1/64th of a denarius. Denarius is the currency we're most familiar with in the New Testament. And a denarius was like one day's wage. And so this is 1/64th of one day's wage. But it makes an impression on Jesus that far outweighs the monetary value. This is what he says, verse 43. He called his disciples to him and he said to them, truly I say to you, this poor widow has put in more than all those who are contributing to the offering box. For they all contributed out of their abundance, but she, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had, all she had to live on. This is God's word. There's our plot twist. Everybody's dropping in different amounts. People can see it. People can hear it. She drops in the tiniest amount in a very humble, hidden way. And Jesus said, that was the biggest offering that happened today. And the reason why is because he's looking at the heart. Jesus, basically, he calls his disciples over. And I think there's probably like kind of this like hushed reverence. He's like, guys, come here, get over here. Did you see what just happened? See her? See that little lady shuffling away? She just put in two lepta and it was everything she had. Jesus is telling them that in his economy, she's made the most significant offering of all. Because everyone else is giving out of their margins, they're giving out of their excess. Maybe they don't even feel it. Maybe they're giving for false motives. Maybe they're giving to be seen. Maybe they're being very intentional to drop the coins in one at a time. Honestly, in the paragraph right before this, Jesus warned people about doing religious things for human motives, to be seen by others. Literally the paragraph right before this. So it's not a stretch to think that some of these people were doing it to be seen. And she's not doing it to be seen. To quote N.T. Wright, he says, her sacrifice, though small, was total. Her sacrifice, though small, was total. So what Jesus was valuing in his economy, it wasn't so much the amount, it was the heart behind it. The other offerings maybe cost relatively little. In fact, may have been done for show, but hers was done for love. to declare her love and her trust in a concrete way. I've spent some time this week just thinking, Jesus, what was it that so captivated you that with everything going on, the conflict, the pending crucifixion, you were captivated by the beauty of this moment to where you called your disciples and said, note this. And again, this is not just about noting it, it's about responding to it, right? Parables, they're always an invitation to respond. I thought a couple things. One, why was Jesus so captivated by this enacted parable? One, it was an act of love and trust and faith-filled worship. She was a steward of what she had, not an owner. We're gonna circle back to that language of steward and owner during our question and answer time. But this was an act of love, of worship. This was somebody saying, I'm all in on you, God. I trust you. I have no one else. I have nothing else. A widow in first century Israel had very little as far as a net. And so she said, I'm all in on you, God. And that's why Jesus was so captivated by it. Secondly, because it was a clear reflection of his own image and nature, she was making the invisible God visible. In a matter of hours, Jesus is going to offer up his life. The offering he's gonna bring, it's everything. It's all that he has. It's himself. He's offering it up for others as an act of worship and for the sake of people. That's who Jesus is. That's what he came to show us, what the Father's like. He came to show us what our Creator's like. And that's what he's about to do. And he's like, she's doing it. In our language, she's making the invisible God visible by being all in, by giving all that she had, by not withholding herself. It's a beautiful moment. I'm gonna invite James and Amberly to come up. We're gonna do some Q&A this morning. I'll share this. Our questions this morning are a combination of questions that you've submitted through the form that we put up each week, questions that we've just been asked interpersonally. People have come up and talked to both James and Amberly and myself. And then also just a few questions that are helpful topics that we didn't get to address in the series. So it's gonna be kind of a mixture of those things. But let me just give you a story to go along with that enacted parable. I think this one's mine. Is this one mine?
This one. Yes.
I'll take this one. No, that one's mine. I can tell by where the seam is. I'm not kidding.
Are you judging me?
No, I'm a detail person.
Okay.
We could tell.
So
there you go.
If I go to a coffee shop, I have to line the logo up with the spout, the drink spout. It's a thing. I'll get healing. So widow's mite, this whole idea of God caring more about our motives than the amount or the appearance. So a few weeks ago during this series, while I was preparing 1 week, it was actually a day, there's certain days of the week that I have kind of blocked out to work on message prep. And it was one of those days. And so this is during the parable of the Good Samaritan. It was the week I was gonna be teaching the Good Samaritan for my part. And I was, I finally got my email box cleaned up, which is I love it when I have zero email waiting for a response. Doesn't happen very often. And it had been a long time since I'd got caught up, and I'd got caught up that week, and I was just feeling sort of the, which is, so I get this email, and it's from the family of a fellow vineyard pastor across the other side of the country. And it's a family who, this pastor's been in health crisis for quite a while now, and they're doing an annual fundraiser for him and for the family. And I participated in this fundraiser in the past, so I get the email. And my first response is, I can't delete this because he's a fellow vineyard pastor. And so I'm like you, I get lots of email solicitation for, you know, financial support for organizations and individuals. But I went to delete it. I couldn't delete it because, like, he's a vineyard pastor and I should do something. And I really wanted my inbox empty. And so I got on my phone and I just participated in this whole thing through Venmo. And I let out a sigh and I archived the email. And the moment I archived it, I had this conviction of the Holy Spirit. that what I had just done was so much less than God's heart. That what I did, I just gave out of duty, fellow vineyard pastor, I can't ignore this one. I gave out of efficiency because I wanted my inbox empty. And what I didn't do is I never stopped to experience compassion. I never stopped to experience compassion. And I'm reading the story, I'm preaching the message about the religious leaders who ignored the guy who was on the side of the road, who was dying, left for dead, and the religious leaders go around him out of efficiency and because no one's watching. And it's the Samaritan who comes along who helps him out of compassion. And I just felt this conviction and I just felt an invitation from the Lord to pause and respond to that. To repent and say, oh God, I don't want to give just out of obligation or duty or for efficiency, but Lord, out of compassion. And so I stopped and prayed for the family. I stopped to experience what they must be going through in a chronic health crisis that's shortening his life. And just to think about what is the, and so to pray for that family. And I share that with you because I think we can give to causes, to the church, to charitable causes, and never actually captivate God's heart. What Jesus was captivated in this moment by this woman wasn't the amount, it was her motives. It was the trust, it was the love that she was extending towards God. And so I just share that to say, as we anchor into this story, as we go through the questions today, think about that. Think about what are our motives, and don't miss the opportunity in your finances to bring it into a place of prayer. That's an opportunity we as Christians have, is to pray about our finances. So we're gonna jump to question number two. If we can put a question two up. Question number one, I'm gonna talk about for a bit. So let's go to question two so you guys can share. So James and Amberlee, how do you balance contentment with wisdom, good stewardship, and hard work?
So the world really throws at us to be in this hustle culture, to be consumers, and really individualism, and really just focusing on ourselves and keeping up with the Joneses. But if we are Jesus followers, the world should not be the lens that we live life through. It should be through what God says and his word. And when I look at Jesus, I can't think of him ever hustling. I can't think of him being a consumer or even an individualism, like focusing on being an individual. He brought in disciples. He didn't need to do that, but he did. He was not trying to keep up with the Joneses. He was very different than what we would expect. And if we want to be followers of Jesus, we should be reflecting him more than what the world's telling us to.
Yeah, I would have to go back. When I grew up, both of my parents were incredibly hard workers, which is a good thing. And I learned an incredible work ethic. And I thought, hard work is the best. Mm-hmm. Like, if you have hard work, you don't need anything else. But what I found is, along with hard work came no rest. And we are commanded to rest. Mm-hmm. In the commandments, take a Sabbath is, I believe it's the longest, most descriptive commandment. Mm-hmm. And so there's this balance between contentment, but also hard work. Because you can get to the place where you're like, oh, I'm so content with my life that you can become complacent, mm-hmm. and lazy. And I don't feel like we can wrap up in 30 seconds what that looks like, where that fine line is. But I do believe that practicing the Sabbath is one of the best workaholic preventions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so if you start taking a Sabbath, if you're not taking a Sabbath, it is a command. It's not a command that is one that's out of obligation. It's a gift that God's given to us. And once we started practicing a Sabbath, and we talked about the Sabbath in one of the previous messages, it started stripping away this need for work at all times. Hmm. We are not built and made to work all the time. There's a point where we need to rest. And I think adding a Sabbath to your daily or your weekly rhythm is going to help you with that fine line between contentment and complacency or laziness. In Proverbs 14:23, it says, all hard work brings a profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. And I think understanding there's a time for hard work and there's a time for rest. And I think that really would help bridge the gap there.
Mm-hmm. And the Bible talks a lot about contentment, and we talked a lot about it in our last week. But 1 Timothy 6:6 has a lot of really great information in it. And so I'm going to share this starting here. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap, and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered far from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. So in verse 10, we hear this a lot about money being the root of all evil, but it's really the love of money. It's, again, a heart issue.
That's right.
And so it's important to pay attention to our heart when it comes to money. Money doesn't have, it's a tool. It's something that can be used for good, and it can also be used for stuff that is really evil. And so it's really based on the motivation that we have when it comes to money. And money is an amplifier. I view this even just like getting married. You start to notice more about yourself when you have someone who's right there. And when you have kids, it also amplifies what is actually inside of you. Just like money, the more that you have of money, the more it shows what your character is like. And so you can be a really miserly poor person, and you can be a really miserly rich person. Yeah. You can also be a very generous poor person, like the widow in this in the passage. And you could also be a very generous rich person. And it really is dependent on your mentality and how you interact with money in your heart.
I'm curious. So I hear you talking about the tension of holding those things in tension of both hard work and trust and contentment. And you mentioned that Sabbath impacted you not just in terms of your family rhythms of rest, but impacted you financially. Can you just unpack that briefly? Like, how did it relate to your finances?
Well, first of all, me being a workaholic, I found even Saturdays I was going out and I was working in the office. Any free time I found me just going and doing and doing and doing and doing. In terms of affecting our finances, we'll talk about this a little bit later. But if you look at we kind of do a traditional like Friday night to Saturday night. Sabbath. That's the way that we've decided to do that. And if you look at most of your bank statements, if you were to organize it by day of week that you spend money, I would venture to guess that Saturday is probably the one that you spend the most money. And imagine, and we'll talk, like I said, about this a little bit, but if you practiced a Sabbath and you rested and you just enjoyed life in the presence of your family, imagine how much more margin you would have in your finances if you didn't use up that free time to go and consume and spend.
That's helpful. Yeah. Okay. Let's go back to question one briefly. This was a question that was submitted pretty early on in the series, a variation of this we heard a couple different times. How do you suggest Christians approach tithing versus charitable giving? And I'm not sure exactly people who asked this question what they meant, but let me just unpack that, because we use a couple different terms here. We talk about charitable giving or offerings. So oftentimes here you'll hear us talk about tithing and offering, and I just want to unpack those, what we mean by those, and what I would encourage, what we would as a church would encourage of you as far as a practice. So tithing is actually an Old Testament law. It's part of the Old Testament practice of God's people that he gave to Israel, which was people were to bring 1/10 of their increase to the tabernacle or the temple. And they were to do that for a couple of reasons. It was kind of a two-sided thing. One, that was what funded the worship. It funded the priest system, the temple system. Everything about it was funded through the congregation bringing 1/10 of their, so tithe means 10th, bringing 1/10 of their increase. So that might have been, you know, if depending on what their industry was. Most of them were agrarian societies, so they were bringing crops in some case. They were bringing animals in some cases. But so that was how it funded the church for our terminology. But it was also important for them as far as remembering that they had a God who was a provider. So it was what provided for the ministry, and it was what also kept their hearts in a regular rhythm of their lives connected to the fact that they had a creator who was their provider, right? So they did that as a regular rhythm. So offerings, then people could also bring offerings that were free will. They could bring peace offerings, thankful offerings. There's different things that people could do that were just open-hearted. They weren't commanded. They were just an opportunity for people to say, God, I'm so grateful for you, and I want to bring this, right? So in the same way in the New Testament church, and specifically here at Vineyard Boise, I'll just talk about our practice. We have both. We talk about tithes and offerings. We say, you know, if you've brought your tithes or offerings this morning, want to bring that, here's how to do that. We talk about the logistics of that. But we mean a couple things. By tithing, what we typically mean is a regular percentage of your income that you give in a regular way to fund the ministry of the church. It's not designated to a specific ministry or a specific project. It's us coming together as a church to provide for us to continue to do ministry. That's how we fund the church. But it also has that part for you. It's a two-sided thing. It's a chance for you to stop and say, God, regardless of who writes my paycheck, or who signs, you know, whoever, you know, if it, my ultimate provider is you. And so in many cases, people actually tithe a tenth of their income. Some people tithe different percentages or different amounts. But what we would say from a New Testament perspective, we don't see New Testament a mandate that everybody has to tithe. We see actually a different conversation, a shift from ownership to stewardship that happens, we see in the New Testament church. So we'll talk about that in a moment. But I do think as a guideline, having a fixed percentage that you give as a regular way is really helpful on both fronts. One, so that the church has regular income, but also so that you have that regular opportunity to stop and recognize where your ultimate source comes from. And so in Andrea's and my life, I'm very grateful. My parents taught me to tithe at a very young age. So when I was making $3.35 an hour at Marie Callender's, they taught me to tithe $8, you know, a month. And but as my income grew, I just kept that same percentage. So that as my income grew, I had that practice. And it wasn't actually until I was actually in ministry that I actually began praying about it and experiencing the opportunity to not just do that as a good practice, but to do that as a heart-shaping place and say, God, would you shape me? And to take that time to pray for the church, for the congregation, to pray for our personal finances. And so that's our practice. We give 10%. We would talk about offerings or charitable giving outside of that. And so sometimes that's here in the church. Sometimes we do a special project and we take up an offering that's in addition to just the normal giving. Or there's also, you know, giving to other wonderful charitable causes, and well, maybe that's supporting a child in compassion or one of those type of things. And so what we've found is that we do both, and we actually take the time to pray at both of those. And that's a place where God not only meets needs through us, but also changes our hearts so that we're less attached and less living in fear and more living in trust. So.
Yeah, and for me, generosity has always been a challenge. I did not start tithing early on in my life, and I feel like that would have been a lot. I wish I did that, but I didn't. And for me, one of the things that has helped me is when I feel like I want to hold on to the money that I have, I recognize that this is an opportunity for me to be generous, because that is how I stop using money as a security blanket for me personally. But for us, one of the things that has helped us on a practical level outside of tithes and offerings is having a generosity fund that we fund monthly. And we use that money for anything that comes up, like if we want to pay for someone's lunch, or if we want to buy Girl Scout cookies or whatever. Like, I don't know, we haven't done that, but as an example, but some kind of like charity that comes along in the way, like it has helped us to have money set aside for those things, and then it just rolls over month to month so that when we see that there is a need, we can fulfill it.
That's awesome. Let's go to question number four. Question number four is, how How do you help your children grow in good financial stewardship at various phases of their lives?
Yeah, so for us, we really view that we need to just model the behavior we want our kids to have. If we're not modeling it, they're following us, and we just don't want to be hypocritical with the way that we live our lives. And so modeling behavior, and we also think about our money story. We're creating our children's money story right now. And how can we give them the best money story to set them up for future success that we can?
And something to think about on that is, what if instead of just thinking and focusing on how you can help your child have a better money story, what can you do with your child to help their children have a better money story? And bringing it one generation further, I think that really changes the way that you start thinking about it.
Yeah, and we can't expect that the schools are going to teach our kids how to handle their finances. And so it's really on us. And if we just keep putting it in the back burner and don't do anything about it, our kids are going to struggle in life. And Proverbs 22 verses 5-7 says, "Thorns and snares are in the way of the crooked. Whoever guards his soul will keep far from them. Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is the slave to the lender." I think it's really interesting when you look at this in context. Like, we love picking out that sixth verse, you know, train up the child in the way they should go, and they won't depart right. from it. But the first part, the verse 5, talks about, like, all these crooked things, like, guard their soul. Like, this is an important thing that we are training our children to pay attention to those things, and also paying attention to debt of rich.
Yeah, and maybe 6 and 7 are connected as well. I mean, maybe it's in that order. You know, train up your child, and then it talks about the rich ruling over the poor. So we're going to give you some practical ways that, just some examples of what we've done with our children. For example, we talk about compounding interest with our kids, and right now they're 7 and 10, and. If they can understand that at an early age, imagine what they can do. So the other day, we typically have an investment calculator that will do some quick investment calculations with our clients. And Amberly thought the other week, like, oh, we should show the kids. So we've been putting money into a 529, the education plan. Recently, I don't know if you know this, but there's been some adjustments in how you can do that. Down the road, our kids can now, if they don't use it for education, they can roll it over to a Roth. And so there's some nuance to how you can do that. But so we were talking to them about this and what it would look like. And we were talking about education. We're talking about investing. We opened up their portfolios and we showed them how much they had, and their eyes got kind of big. And then we said, now here's what happens. If you ended up not using this for education and you used it at retirement, based on the percentage that you're getting right now, here's what it'll be. We plugged in the numbers, and Jonathan, our son's, for those of you that don't know, our last name is Rich. He looks at me and he goes, I really am rich. And so awesome. So the little bit that they have right now would turn into close to $1 million for one and over $1 million for the other. And wow. So having that open up, but then not only the investment side, also the debt side, showing them what 30% on a debt can look like, right. That really does a lot for the kids to understand.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think also some more practical ideas is having your kids join you in those daily tasks. When you're at the grocery store, it's a lot easier just grocery shop while the kids are sitting in the cart and, like, not actually telling them how to do it. And what I've been trying to do is just teach them how to look at the prices, how to pick out produce, how to do all of the things. Mm. This past week, they went through, they did the entire grocery shopping. Like, my daughter is pushing the cart. I'm like, you're going to need to know how to do this. So you're going to be practicing that. And they did the self-checkout, and they ended up bagging everything up and paying for it. I mean, they used our money, but like practice, like, using a debit card and putting it through, and just having your kids do the tasks. Like, I think a lot of times we think that they're just too young to know how to do those kind of things, but all those little things are going to be benefiting them in their future.
Did you tell them what your PIN is?
Yes.
Wow, that's a bold move.
Our daughter can tell, like, she sees something and she has it totally memorized for years. Like, we can't keep it.
It's dangerous.
It is.
Your secret code's not secret anymore.
I know, yeah. It's not.
Let's go to question number 5. What is your best financial advice for people at various phases of life? What a great question.
So we talked a little bit about kids. I did want to circle back and say that one of the most important things for us in our parenting is helping our children fail. So if they can fail when they're under our roof, under the safety of our umbrella, they can learn how to succeed. And so I was having a conversation earlier today, and we were talking about how we've made mistakes in our finances. And a wise steward makes mistakes, but it's what they do after that mistake that really matters. And so you may have made a lot of mistakes in your finances. What are you going to do next? And that's what we try to train our kids. Right. So when they're under our roof, we help them fail with pennies before they have dollars. And if we can do that, then the mistakes that they could be making down the road kind of go away, and because they've learned how to fail up until that time. So that's kids within that age group. Once young adults, college age, about 20s, I would say one of the pieces of advice that we got, especially after we graduated, was live like a college student as long as you can. The longer you can avoid lifestyle creep, the better. If you get intentional early on, it's so much better. We talked a little bit about investing and compounding interest. Start investing even when you're in college. One of the best things my dad told me in college about finances was take the match. So I had a job while I was working in college. Right. They did a 3% match. That 3% was not that much. I didn't miss it. But now I look and I see how much that 3% has turned into, right, with the match, which turned into 6%. Like, it's 100% growth right then and there. And then you have compounding interest that works for you. So if you can learn as a young adult to start investing now, that's great. Also, in your 20s, if and when you get married, you'll become a dink, double income, no kids. Amberly and I, we were dinks for a while, and we tried living on less than one income, because we put money aside. We came up with a bunch of goals that we wanted to do, and we started funding those goals early and often. And that's one of the most important things when you're in college and in your 20s that I would say.
So for 30s to retirement time, like, that's a huge span of time. Mm-hmm. This is a really important place to really have a plan. It's easy to be in survival mode, especially if you have kids, you've got a lot of things going on, you're juggling a lot. And so having a plan, being intentional with what you have, paying off debt, investing regularly, and then focusing on your priorities. And these are your highest income earning years, so using it as wisely as possible is really important. Another thing is, if you have kids, if you're married, having term life insurance is really beneficial. So that way it will give you peace of mind. So if one of you passes away, you could still live in your house. You wouldn't have the stress of like figuring out how to make ends meet.
Do you have a recommended website for, like, I know term life, you can kind of shop it around and get a broker that gives you a bid. Do you have one that you'd recommend?
Not typically. We have people just go look at some different options with a brokerage, because then they can
But shopping shop is important.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. In terms of retirement, obviously we got a ways before we're there, but we've worked with a lot of our clients that are in retirement. The biggest thing we have for you guys is it's not too late to get intentional. You may feel like you've missed the boat. You haven't. You can still be intentional with your finances. There's things like the Roth catch-up contributions. You can put an extra $1,000 into that over at the age of
50.
We recommend towards retirement, best you can, be debt-free, pay off your mortgage. These are guidelines, not rules. We also say that when you're in your retirement, dream. We talked about dreams before. The dreams don't have to end when you retire.
That's right.
Figure out what you want your retirement to look like. Put the things into place that will get you that. And then organize end-of-life documents, which kind of ties into our next question.
I'm going to jump to, we'll go to question 6. Do you have suggestions for helping think through end-of-life type decisions? Finishing well, wills, trust, power of attorney, things like that.
Yeah, I think it's important to know the difference between a trust versus a will. A will is not as robust as a trust. And if you have $100,000 net worth, it's really recommended to have a trust. The hard part about the trust, that is the reason why most people don't do it, for one, there's some effort into it, but the cost of a trust typically is $3,000 to $5,000, is the typical price point for it.
Yeah. Can I talk about that for just a second?
Yeah.
Okay, so let me give you a save the date. If we can put that save the date slide up. We have a ministry we've been partnering with for several years now, I think about 8 years. And so this is actually, it's called Financial Planning Ministry, and they're in partnership with Mission Aviation Fellowship. They come annually and offer a service where they give an overview of these same things. They go into detail about difference of will versus trust and things like that. And if you choose to set up a trust, they will walk you through that and do that with you and for you for free. So it's an amazing gift. And they also deal with end of life type documents, thinking about health directives, where do your kids go if your kids are under, if you're minors, all that type of stuff. Andrea and I did that the second year that they were here. So this was probably 7 years ago. It was so helpful for us. Now it's time for us to review it and update it, because it's some of the dynamics have changed. But it was such a gift to us to have the peace of mind that everything was into a trust. So save the date for that. They are coming Sunday, September 15th. That'll be after church. It'll just be a after church workshop. And that's all completely free. It's an amazing gift.
Yeah, you save thousands of dollars on the front end, but you can also save thousands of dollars on the back end by preventing your estate from going into probate.
Yeah.
Probate could be very costly and take a lot of time. And so you can save a lot of money by going to that workshop. I highly recommend it. Amberly and I both did that same thing.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to say anything else on that one?
One other thing I would say is there's I think it's fivewishes.org. Mm-hmm. This is a really good website. We used it when my mom was passing. What we went through, it's advanced care planning program. And so I took my dad and my mom through that and had them fill it out. It's questions like, if you... are you end of life? You can't communicate. What are the things that you want done? And that gave us so much peace of mind knowing that we're doing for my mom exactly what she wants when she can't communicate for herself. So if you have kids, if you have somebody that's going to take care of you in your old age when you can't take care of yourself, help them out by filling out something like Five Wishes. It's very cheap. You can get a paper copy, I think, for $5, a digital copy for something like $20 or $30. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a legal document, but it really helped us with, James has three other siblings, and we all could be on the same page, mm-hmm. and we weren't put in challenging positions figuring out end-of-life information for her.
I want to add one more thing on that question of... things for helping people finish well, end of life. So this isn't end of life, but it's moving towards retirement. Something that Andrea and I, we're in a two-year coaching cohort, financial cohort provided by Vineyard USA right now that we're going through. But one of the things they did on the front end is they had us go to the Social Security Administration website and set up an account. If you haven't already done that, you can do this at any age, but especially if you're starting to think about retirement, go to socialsecurityadministration.gov, set up an account, and what it will tell you is what your projected income will be through Social Security, depending on when you retire. And it'll give you three benchmarks for like early retirement, full retirement, or delayed retirement. And you can see exactly what you'll make, like projected, at like age 62, age 67, age 70. And it's shocking how beneficial it is if Social Security is a part of your retirement income. It's shocking to see how much benefit there is in delaying it as long as you possibly can. And so it's really helpful, and it'll help you plan and think through, maybe I need to think about how to work longer before I hit that retirement age and start drawing on that. I wanna go back to question, we're running out of time here. So I'll say this, our final question is gonna be, what can you expect from the Financial Peace Workshop? There's so much more that James and Amberly have to offer us. Really encourage you to come next Saturday or this coming Saturday for that workshop. But I want to go back to this question number three. How can I shift my thinking from ownership to stewardship? Ownership is when we think about our money. This is what the default in 21st century America is, anything that I have is mine. And a Christian worldview is, I'm a steward of everything I have. My life, my talents, my time, my finances, right? Everything. And it's so hard to live from there because the culture is constantly pulling us back into ownership. So I want to offer two things to help us as Christians grow in thinking as stewards, not as owners. The first is, we talked about tithing. We're not heavy-handed with tithing here at the Vineyard, but we do believe a practice of giving regularly and giving in a way that costs, that you actually feel it, mm-hmm. not just the excesses in your pocket on a Sunday if you happen to be here, but actually like giving a regular amount that you feel. And tithing has that effect. And that's an opportunity to stop and pray and say, God, thank you for your provision in my life. I could do something else with this. And I'm choosing to trust you and worship you through my giving and giving to a something that's a kingdom extending, you know, organization, whether that's a church or your local church or a charitable organization. But so that's a chance to stop and pray about that. The other thing and this is a new development for me that just happened during this series, is I realized that I do pray for a long time now. I've prayed about my charitable giving and my tithing. I have never prayed about my bills. And I realized that if I stop to pray about my bills, there's an opportunity there for that exercise to be a heart-shaping thing for me as well, and to live more as a steward and less as an owner. And so to stop and pray and about my electricity bill that I don't really love paying, but to stop and pray and thank God that I can pay it, and also that I have electricity, that I have air conditioning and hot water and heat, and to think about the people in our world who don't, the vast majority of our world who don't have the same things that we have, and to pray for a heart of compassion for them and to pray for their provision. Like, paying bills can literally be a place of shaping our character to be more like Jesus, to be more compassionate. And so I've been doing that. I mean, yesterday I was paying our sewer bill, and I was thinking about people I've been to many places in the world where they do not have sewer, and everything's running in the street, and there's disease because of that, and unpleasant environments. And to think, God, I'm so thankful for sewer. So West Boise Sewer, God bless you, you know?
Yeah. Along with that, real quick, how many of you guys remember the Grace Project that we did, where during offering 1 week, the church handed out $100 bills instead of us putting money in? You guys remember that? And we were asked to steward that well and make kingdom impact. What was crazy about that was we heard so many, and even for us, when the church handed you a $100 bill and said, okay, do something wise with this, I saw so many people just set on that and think and pray and think and pray until they made action, they acted. And that's because they realized that wasn't their money. It was given to them. Yeah. Psalms 24:1 says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. Everything we have is God's. Mm-hmm. What if we had that same intention, that same thought process, the same prayer about the paychecks, the money coming in? Could you imagine what would be different? From that thing, from the Grace Project, I heard about new ministries being birthed. I heard about new businesses starting, all because of an intentional act with $100.
Yeah, and awesome. The thing is all of our $100 bills, our entire paycheck is just like that $100.
Yeah, if you want to be, if you want to trust God with your finances, which I really think, I brought this up, I find it funny that the thing that we have the hardest time trusting God with, our finances, it's printed on there, in God we trust. Like, once we make the shift from ownership to stewardship, that's when we have a much easier time trusting God with his own resources.
Yeah, and if you take the piece of paper you have that you got at the door, I have the Good Steward Prayer. This is a prayer I wrote to help me every morning. I pray it in my head, and I have it printed off, and I just go through it, and I use it to reorient my life and my mind, because it's so easy to get back to feeling like I'm the owner of everything that I have, and it's just not true. And so I would recommend for you all as homework this week to go and pray this in the morning, and doing it first thing. So I kneel down, sounds kind of crazy, next to my bed every morning as a physical sign of praying on my knees, and I pray this prayer. And I would recommend that you all try something like this. You can write your own prayer if you'd like, but having something to reorient your mind every morning is really beneficial.
Alicia, if we could go to the last, the sign-up QR code. We'll put the sign-up. We had more content we were prepared to cover today, one of which is this question, and I'm just going to tease it out right now, but we're not going to answer it. How can I find more margins within my current income? And James and Amberly have some very practical ideas that right where you are right now, to be able to say, there are margins. It may feel like I'm stuck, but there are margins that you have, that I have, that they're going to help with. But we're going to answer that question Saturday morning. And so we're going to put up the registration one last time and encourage you to sign up for that workshop. And we'll address any other questions then. Can we do that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can we thank James and Amberly? This was just a gift of love to their church family. This is what they do with their lives. They are financial coaches, but they are giving out of their vocational life and gifts and passions to their local church. And I'm so grateful for that. So here's how we're going to close this morning. If you're on campus, you got one of these Good Steward prayers as you came in. If you didn't get one, they'll be at both doors. You can grab one as you leave. I'd encourage you to take this and keep it, not just for this series, but keep it in a place where you can keep praying through it and reflect back on it. If financial stewardship is something you want to grow in, this is a good prayer to start with. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to ask you, if you're on campus, to stand. And I just want to close in prayer. And I'm going to actually pray this over us. But I want to give you one invitation, and it's this. This is not a small thing. When we start talking about money, money's an incredibly powerful thing, and it's neutral. It can be used for evil, and it can be used for great good. And our desire is to put ourselves under God's lordship, under Jesus' teaching, and to experience goodness while living in a human economy, experience people that are rooted in a kingdom economy. Right, we're aliens in this world. We're temporary resident aliens, waiting for a permanent home. And so, if this series, or even maybe you're just here for the first time this morning, if this has stirred in you a desire to grow in this, and you're asking God to help you grow in this area of stewardship, and to grow as even in being able to be entrusted with more. You know, kingdom principle, he who is faithful with little will be given more. And so to be entrusted with more, if you're stirred to change and want to ask God to bring that change in you, I'm just going to ask you to raise your hand right where you are, just as a way of saying, God, I want to vote with my life. I'm asking you to do this. And as we close, I'm just going to read this prayer over us and pray that God would help all of us as a church family to grow both individually and together. Lord, you are my provider, my daily bread. Would you help me to recognize your good gifts from above? Empower me to make choices that line up with your heart. And help me to be content with what you've given me. Guide my steps and decisions, for they impact more than just me. Give me wisdom and discipline to use your resources well, to build your kingdom on earth as it is in heaven. Forgive my shortcomings, my unbelief, and my selfishness. Let me steward all that you give me well for the benefit of others and for future generations. Thank you for your continued faithfulness, for you are my provider. And I trust in you. Amen.